Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
I'm Julia Tertian, host of Radio Cherry Bomb. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 129 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sarah Kamen.
On today's show, Talia Bayoki, editor-in-chief of online wine, spirits, and cocktail magazine Punch, and author of the new book, The Modern Guide to Sherry. We'll talk with her about all of those things. Welcome to The Morning After. Talia.
Hi. Oh, hi.
Hi. Oh, hi.
I'm still waking up.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Later in the show, we will morning after quiz Talia. Today's topic.
I like that's now a verb.
It is 100%. Today's topic
you got
is
so morning after.
It's Hawaiian Punch, and I'm feeling confident that we will still keep our streak of no one winning the morning after quiz.
Yes,
it's guaranteed.
Well, don't speak too soon. I'm still worried. You do know a lot about beverages in general. All right, but first, Sarah, you've got some food news for us.
I do. Yeah, there was some food news in the news this week.
There was some news in the news.
There was some food in the news. Okay, well, I know we spent a lot of time talking about weird kind of gross creations coming out of fast food restaurants, and that streak will continue. But this time we're talking about vegetables, in fact. McDonald's.
Of course they're making vegetables gross.
Well, which is gross just to think about McDonald's making vegetables.
I know. It's like I didn't even have to say anything, yeah. And you guys are already rolling with it's like, and next. it's like vegetables McDonald's, yeah. Done. Well, this is really bad. They attempted to do something with broccoli because they wanted to kind of counter the argument that McDonald's isn't doing anything to promote healthy eating in terms of, you know, children eating fruits and vegetables. So apparently they tried to manufacture broccoli that tasted like bubble gum.
What? No.
Yeah. No. But
bubblegum
shockingly,
flavor is gross, yeah. Also.
But shockingly, it didn't happen because when they tried it on, you know, some test children, they were, quote, confused by the taste.
I really want to know who these test children
were. They in cages?
Yeah. I'm just confused by like the concept, like who came up with that. I'm just confused by the whole thing. So I'm not surprised that the taste was equally as confusing as just the idea.
You're supposed to put cheese on broccoli to make kids eat it.
That's all you had to do.
Say.
Just put a little cheese on it. Ranch. Give it a little ranch.
Do you guys
dip?
Remember that commercial for cheese when they put cheese on broccoli and like the tagline was "Cheese makes it better"? That's it.
Come on, McDonald's. They've been trying to get in the brassicas game for like a while now, and it's like not working out.
It's not working. Yeah. So anyway, the plan sadly was nixed, and it didn't happen. So
lucky kids everywhere are rejoicing.
They have to stick with, quote, healthy options like yogurt and chicken.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is kind of funny. I don't know if you guys out there watch the show Cake Boss that's on TLC. Talia, have you ever seen it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So this guy, he's the cake boss. His name is Buddy Velastro. Let's just let that ruminate. His name is Buddy. He was arrested this past week on Thursday at around 1:30 in the morning in New York City because he was drunk driving. He was driving a yellow Corvette, and he was apparently driving pretty crazy. He was swerving in and out of lanes. He got pulled over. You know, he blew the little whistle. It blew up because he was so drunk. And he was arrested. But the best part about this, I'm not happy that he got arrested for drunk driving. It's not something we condone here. But the part that I do like is his response was, "You can't arrest me. I'm the cake boss."
I feel like that's like a pretty good.
It's pretty
good. That's a pretty good response. Like, I would say, you know, maybe I can't.
Yeah.
Cake boss.
He may not be the boss of all things, but he is the boss of cake.
It's gonna be my answer to everything.
Do it.
Everything
like
at work.
The staff's ultimate, like, do you know who I am?
Exactly.
Kind of moment.
The staff's like, I need a day off. I'm like, I'm the cake boss. Don't ask me for anything.
That's it. That's all you need to say. And then he allegedly also said, can you just put me in a cab? I don't have to be arrested. I'm not a bad guy. Which is probably, you know, the one thing that all criminals should have thought of before.
Missing the point, Cake Boss.
Yes.
Yeah. Isn't Cake Boss just kind of implying
mafioso? Can't you just call Uber for me or something? Yeah. Like, be a pal here.
Yeah. Uber police car.
And then lastly, finally, all of our dreams are coming true. A meow parlor. The meow parlor. The cat bar. The cat cafe is finally opening in New York. Jess, if you could see Jessie's face out there, it looks like she ate something very bitter and sour.
No, I'm just like, I own a cat and I fight daily with his hair. So yeah. The idea of, is the cat cafe actually food related or is it just for cuddling?
Oh no, it's for cuddling pastries and cats alike. It's a combination patisserie / kitten kingdom. It is being opened by Christina Ha and Emily Legrand of the bakery and pop-up market regular Macaron Parlor. So they've moved from macarons to meows.
Cats.
That was
which neighborhood?
I believe it's the Lower East Side. I know they had a pop-up before that was entirely successful.
I mean,
and there's a couple rules. Guests will be able to bring their food into the cat room, but the cats are not allowed into the food room.
Okay.
So there's that, and that apparently keeps the health department happy.
Is there smoking in the cat bar?
Not that I know of. I believe that's generally illegal in all bars. But there's a few stipulations that I want to point out, just to get you ready. All cats from the Cat Rescue Center come from the Cat Rescue Center, and they are adoptable, so that's kind of great. I would want to take them all home for sure. Kids under 10 can only come in during special hours and have to be with an adult, so definitely avoid those hours if you're not a child. No shoes allowed in the cat room, which I think is kind of weird.
This is all just making me unhappy.
The cat room has Wi-Fi. Thank God. And finally, the space is available for private events.
And they only play Taylor Swift songs.
What was it, Talia? You were at Eater. What's the like? It's Suicide Watch or like
Death Watch?
Death Watch. It's already on Death Watch.
It's done.
It's already done. Like it's gonna open. It's gonna close.
Are you kidding?
The adoption aspect is actually like okay. That gives it like a few extra points. But I don't. Can you bring your own cat? Is it BYOC? Bring your own cat? No,
no,
not at all.
That means your cat is automatically adoptable, and so someone else can take it home.
That would be the cause of so many like serious injuries. Yeah. Also,
if someone could come up and be like, I'm gonna order a croissant and that person's cat.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking about transporting a cat. I've done it once. I'm gonna try never to do it again.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm holding out for the dog cafe. Until
sure
then,
coming soon. Yeah. No food around
my pastries and pastry shops only. Thank you very much.
Oh man,
just kidding.
Sari, those were some really good food newses for today.
Well, thank you to the food news god.
Absolutely. We're gonna take a break here on The Morning After. We're gonna come back with Talia Bayoki.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
It was kind of, like, I heard, and we're back late here on The Morning After. Sari Kamen.
Hey.
I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sari Kamen. I'm in trouble.
She was
sorry, I was talking about cereal with Talia.
So good. It's so good.
Yeah.
Well, that's who's in the studio today. She was the first ever wine editor for Eater. She just wrote one of the most comprehensive and cool books about sherry, and she spends her day job as the editor-in-chief of Punch, an online magazine about wine, spirits, cocktails, and all the culture in between. Talia Baiocchi, welcome to The Morning After.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
We're
and
so
I'm so glad
here
that it's not actually morning.
It's the
thank
morning
you
after,
guys for that.
The morning, yeah, the morning after is never a part of the
no
a.m.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's right.
It's just our
we should call it
exactly
after
it
the morning
be
instead of the yeah morning after.
Something like that, exactly. So I guess to get things started, you have a degree in journalism from NYU. What pushed you towards beverage journalism?
Ooh. Well, I started working in a restaurant when I was in college, and it was a tiny little restaurant called The Mermaid Inn in the East Village. So I don't know if you guys know that restaurant.
Yeah,
it's super
course
tiny, but very, very busy. And so I had a job there my junior and senior year of college as a hostess. And honestly, till this day, best job I've ever had, because you like learn how to deal with like a lot of assholes. And that's very important. And there I started like being a part of the staff training and drinking wine, and it sort of clicked for me. Like, I always loved art history, and wine had like for my brain a similar, like my memory worked with wine in some way. And so they let me taste wine before I was 21, and I started
shh
reading all about it. And I got really into it, and then I graduated from college, and I took all of the money that my relatives sent, and I went to Italy, and I worked the harvest in Piemonte, and then I sort of traveled around until I ran out of money, and then I came back to New York, and I was like, well, how the hell do you get into the wine industry? And so I went on Craigslist. And
back when people
back
did.
When, yeah, well, yeah, back
before
Craigslist
you could get killed
viable
by going on Craigslist routinely. And I typed in wine, and I applied to the sort of only job that came up, and that was at Italian Wine Merchants. And so I was there for like 2.5 years and drank a lot of wines that I had no business drinking. And, you know, I knew that I didn't want to, you know, work and find wine in that way and sell wine. And so I was like writing this like really weird blog that like no one read. And somehow that rolled into a career in writing about wine. How, I do not know. And I'm so glad it does not exist on the internet anymore.
I was going to say, I want to find this.
I'm sure there's like some archive somewhere that will be unearthed by some horrible person that hates me at some point.
Just don't run for office.
Yeah, yeah, right.
The internet is forever.
Yeah, it is indeed.
So what was going on in the wine world when Eater appointed you first wine editor?
What was going on in the wine world? I mean, it was going. People were drinking wine. It was happening, all happening. And you know, I think this was kind of the beginning of like sommeliers really like, you know, kind of becoming celebrities in their own right, and being able to sort of like carry a restaurant and be like the face of a restaurant. And so I think for Eater, it was an amazing thing on their part. Amanda Clute, who's a friend of mine, who is an amazing editor and just an amazing person, you know, sort of took a chance with this column I started writing for Eater New York, and felt like there was really a place for talking about wine lists. And that ended up kind of rolling into talking about wine in more of a general sense, because I think everyone started to realize that these audiences that are reading about food in restaurants, it's the same audience that it, you know, is reading about wine or interested in wine a lot of the time, not all the time. And you know, the wine world has changed dramatically since then. This was like 2009. So yeah, a lot has, I mean, the wine world in New York specifically has come like a long way since then, for sure.
I loved reading your Eater exit post. Specifically the part where you say, if you miss me or simply miss telling me I'm a dummy, you can find me on Twitter, your Twitter handle. What is beverage geek hate mail like?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Honestly, like, the wine world is a funny place, and it is this subculture that is like, And I appreciate this about it, honestly. As much as I hated it at that point, and, like, being in your mid-20s and people, like, telling you you're an asshole all the time on the internet is, like, not the greatest.
No, it doesn't feel good. Mm-hmm. And it's on there forever.
No, I'm actually glad, though. Exactly. I'm actually glad that that all happened, because I kind of, like, grew up in, you know, on Eater. And I didn't have all the answers, and I made a lot of mistakes. And I, you know, I was just, like, you know, I was being honest about what my opinion was. And it was, like, really hard. But, yeah, there is, like, there are people who are, like, incredibly intense about details and facts. And this is so important, I think, you know, and this is something I respect so deeply about the wine world. But, you know, if someone has a different opinion than someone else in wine, it is, like, somehow attack on their, like, them as a person. There is this, like, sort of political, people align themselves in wine with certain things, and it becomes, like, a part of their identity. And so when you say something that is, like, sort of at odds with that, it's almost like attacking them as a person. It's like but it was, you know, that was, like, a really tough thing to be young like that and like putting myself out there and knowing that you know, no matter what I said, that someone was gonna not like it.
But you know, when does that go? Internet. Yeah, I mean, the thing about the wine world that's always kind of frustrated me is that it is sort of like a black hole in the way that it can kind of just go forever. And is it snobby to be one of those people? I mean, when does it go too far? You know, it's like, isn't the point pleasure? Like, at the end of the day, I mean, aren't we drinking wine because of the satisfaction we get and how much we appreciate, you know, this varietal or that varietal or love, you know, thinking about the terroir? I mean, when does that sort of get co-opted by, like,
the geekery?
Yeah,
for sure. I think that, like, there's a big difference between understanding something and, like, wanting to conquer it. Like, they're two very different things. And I think you find those two people taking two very different avenues to approaching wine in the wine world. And, like, with the book, like, people are like, oh, well, you're, like, a sherry expert. I'm like, I'm not an expert on anything, honestly. This is a wine that's, like, 3,000 years old. Like, for me to be like, oh, I'm an expert on this, that's a ridiculous thing to say. Like, I came at it as someone who really didn't know that much and wanted to find out. Like, I think that there is not enough of that in the wine industry where people are allowing other people to figure it out. Like, ask questions. Like, everyone's afraid to ask questions in the industry because it's all about, like, showing how much you know about this vineyard, soil, like this like intense sort of detail driven thing that kind of ends up missing the bigger picture, which is, like, this is good.
Right.
To drink.
I think the same thing is happening in food. You know, you go to restaurants and there's these, like, very esoteric ingredients on these kind of, like, polarizing tasting menus. And people are, like, now afraid to be like, what the hell is this? Whatever, like, sea foam. And, you know, it's like, no one wants to admit that they don't already know that.
Yeah.
And I think the point of going out and enjoying these things and even having sommeliers in the first place is learning.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, it's like, it's supposed to be a delicious experience.
I totally agree. Yeah.
And I want to say that, you know, to that note, your website, Punch, has so much information on it. But at the same time, it doesn't feel polarizing in that way. It's like, it's very accessible, it's very friendly. And how do you do that? I mean, how do you create something that has so much content and so much information, but do it in a way where I don't feel overwhelmed and I'm actually drawn towards it because of the way that it's organized?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that for us, like, it also, Leslie Pariseau, who is my partner in crime and Punch, like, has so much to do with this as well. I mean, it's such an equal effort. And I think that both of us had spent enough time in both industries, her on the cocktail and spirit side, me on the wine side, and kind of wanted to create something that felt like it was answering the question of, like, why does this matter, but not getting so wrapped up in all of the details that we forgot about the big picture. And I think we always try to keep that in mind. Like, we're just trying to do, honestly, like, we really are just trying to produce stories that we're interested in. And it's really nice to see that other people are interested in that as well. I think that, we were just, it's as simple as that. It's really hard to create that much content. We have amazing writers that have come on board and have supported us from the beginning and have made it possible. Like, we're nothing without those people. So we've just managed to kind of put together, like, a really young group of people who have a very similar point of view and want to just talk about why this is so awesome, why alcohol is more than just getting drunk. And that's a lot of it too. Like, that's at least 50% of it. But, like, there is that whole other 50% that all of that sort of the cultural aspect of why we drink, where we drink, and how we drink that I think was not really being talked about that much, unfortunately.
Who do you feel like your audience is for Punch?
Well, we know. Thank you, internet. Thank you, analytics. Well, it's it, you know, it is it, it's a it's an urban audience for sure, and the age group sort of is like between 25 and 35 is like really where it kind of lies at the moment. And I think these are people who are already interested in drinking in some way. Or there's also what we've tried to do is create, excuse me, and over the next like. Over the next year, it's about, you know, creating a site that is also a resource. So, like, you have people who are coming that are reading articles because they, like, already know about, you know, Negronis and they want to, like, learn more about Negronis. But we also want it to be a place where, like, if you really don't know anything, then it's still, you know, like, an inviting, open place where you can learn. We have this whole A to Z glossary where, like, if you don't know what gin, like, you want to learn about gin really quickly, we've got like 300 words that give you like a quick overview about what gin is. And that's important to me too, because I think that that so much of that is lacking, just basic, super super basic knowledge.
Well, and so adding on to that, mm-hmm. you are launching a city guide section.
Yes.
Of Punch.
Yeah, I mean, it
for, and you're tired.
And I'm really, really tired. And I've been drinking, like, a lot of wine. It's, like, one of those things when you're working late, you're like, wow, I just drank a whole bottle of wine, and I didn't even remember that.
It was for work, though, right?
I'm amazed that you can actually put those two things together, work and
wine. I mean, I've
by the
never...
time I'm at the end, I'm like, I'm done writing this email. Yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, that's, like, I think the biggest thing about this job is, like, you really have to... able to like work and drink at the same time. And so that's a skill that I'm really proud of. But
mom and dad.
Yeah. No, they're very proud. They really are. But yeah, so City Guides is part of this like sort of offshoot of making Punch a site that is like sort of more service for someone who's like kind of coming in and looking for a little bit of guidance. And it is exactly what it sounds like in context, which is a city by city guide to drinking around the world. And we're launching with about 15 cities and it'll be, you know, everything from Tokyo to Berlin to San Francisco to Chicago. And these city guides have like a narrative overview of like, what is the city like to drink in right now? Plus like, you know, interactive maps and lists of the best, you know, places to drink wine, the best, you know, sort of, standing bars in Tokyo, the best hidden bars in Berlin, all of this stuff. And we've had like an incredible, like we've had 32 people and 7 illustrators working on this project from the beginning. And, it is intense. It's about like 100,000 words altogether of content that we're launching with. Which, to put it in context, my book was like 60,000. So this is like a lot of words. But it's super fun. And I just always found myself kind of like when I was going somewhere, you know, I'd go on Food and Wine, I'd go on Bon Appetit, I'd go like just searching mm-hmm. for places to drink. And we were like, okay, well, we're like a drink site. We might as well kind of make city guides that are based around drinking. So we're excited about it.
So how did you do the research? Did you go to Tokyo? Did you go to Berlin?
I mean, I've been to Berlin. I've not been to Tokyo. We have people in each city. So sometimes in some cities, we have 5 different people that are working on the city guide. In some cities, we have 2 different people that are working on the city guide. Everyone who is working on the city guides for that city are actually based in the city, which is really important mm-hmm. to us. We also have people who are fact checking everything, which is, you know, rare for the internet. But, you know, we wanted to get this
what?
Right. Yeah. Facts. Yeah, so we were like through a ton of people who helped us. We ended up kind of putting together this like sort of like crack team of people in each city.
Yeah. So to that point that you guys are now creating mm-hmm. your own city guides, I guess my question is about trends that have been happening yeah. in the wine world, in the cocktail world, you know, I guess maybe even for like the last decade, we've seen so many changes happening.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like my chicken or the egg question, mm-hmm. you know, as a journalist and someone who's writing about cocktails and spirits, are you commenting on these trends that you see, or are you creating the trends and then you're witnessing them happening?
Oh God, I don't think we're creating any trends. I don't know if we're there yet or we'll ever be there yet. I think that for us, we just try to find what is interesting in people who are kind of part of that avant-garde and understanding why they're doing what they're doing. I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah, and then I guess like the part yeah. two of that question is
yeah.
why do these trends occur? And yeah. like to be specific, you know, Jesse and I were having this chat that in Brooklyn, you know, for a while now, it feels like every single cocktail menu in Brooklyn is comprised of drinks made from, you know, brown liquor or like maybe gin. But mm-hmm. like, what happened to vodka? When I go back to California
yeah,
and
question.
I see my family, I go to a restaurant and there's like 15 different vodka cocktails and there's no bourbon. Yeah. Why is it so different? And then how do these trends happen so specifically geographically?
Yeah, it's. Poor vodka. I mean, vodka's really had a tough go. And you know, I love like a good vodka tonic. I will drink that all day long. I will pound vodka.
Yes,
tonics.
And I love dirty martinis, and I feel sort of like embarrassed about it. And that feels.
I don't think there's anything to be embarrassed about. I think we're kind of coming of age. I think it's true of wine too. That like everyone was like trying so hard to like be, you know, to do the thing that felt like it was like the right thing instead of just doing what they wanted to do. Yeah. I mean, that's like very vague. But with wine, it was like. I think everyone was so concerned about doing the thing that was cool than just like saying, I really like this because I like it. And I think that's happening in cocktails too. Like it's coming around. Like the craft cocktail movement is like really new, you know, and we're talking about the last like 15 years basically. And so I think there is this thing that's happening where it's kind of people are, you know, this whole kind of like be quiet in this like be you know be quiet in this bar and really respect our craft and we're you know doing this really important thing, which is true that they
suspenders.
Are. Yeah, because right, and I think that what's happening now is people are like I kind of want to also have fun.
Yeah,
here.
Exactly. Back to the putting the fun, injecting the fun back into drinking.
It's happening everywhere, and I think it's just a sign of maturity. Honestly, like I think both of these worlds are maturing finally to say, look, like we just kind of want to do what we want to do, and there's diversity is good. All of this is good. You get to choose. Like that is the ultimate, like when you've reached like the top of like, you know, maturity, I think it's just being able to say, okay, we're going to offer a point of view, but like you get to, we're not going to make you feel bad for liking something that we don't like, you know, like there isn't like a, there isn't like some sort of cultural judgment on that, you know? And I think that's...
I don't know if that's happened yet, though. I mean, I still...
Not fully, no.
But you see it happening.
I see it happening. I see it happening in the types of bars that are opening, the types of craft cocktail bars that are opening. Like, you look at Mother's Rune in New York, which is, like, a really good just bar that happens to serve really great cocktails. But you, like, people are nice to you when you walk in there. They look at you. They make eye contact. They pour you a good drink. And that's it. Like, it doesn't have to be this kind of, like, shrine to the craft, you know? And I think that we're starting to see this more and more. And I feel like if we had this conversation 5 years from now, we would probably be saying different things, I think. I hope.
Good, because I do like dirty vodka. I'm
not going to
lie.
That's fine,
girl. I like dirty vodka, and I cannot lie.
Yeah, I hear you.
Well, speaking of things that are certainly in fashion at the moment.
And weird.
But also so freaking ancient. Yeah. You wrote...
Just kind of classic.
One of the most comprehensive and very cool books about sherry, A Modern Guide to Sherry, by you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Why? I mean, I guess... I know a lot of people on the sherry train. Yeah. What got you involved in this sherry?
Well, I think that like the central question of the book, and for me, is something I'm still trying to answer, is like, why does this weird thing exist? Like, it's as simple as that. Is this thing that like this wine that sort of felt like it grew up like in isolation from the rest of the wine world with this tradition of production that is so strange and different, and it has managed to survive. You know, at times almost, you know, it's been threatened by a whole lot of things. But I think I first started drinking sherry back in 2007 when I was working around the corner from Bar Jamón. And, you know, I kind of was captivated by it. I just like didn't understand it. I really just didn't understand it. And I think now I'm still trying to understand it. Like, I really don't understand this wine because it is something that I think that's the beauty of it. It just doesn't let you understand it. You know, it wants you to keep asking questions. And I had no idea what I was getting myself into, honestly, because it is something that I will be trying to understand for the rest of my life, for sure.
For listeners out there, can you just give, I'm sure you can do this better than me, you know, give just like a quick description of what sherry is.
Yeah. So sherry is a wine that sort of begins like any other wine. You know, it comes from a great place, this beautiful white soil in southwestern Spain, and this very tiny little thing called the Sherry Triangle, about 100 miles from Sevilla. But it is a wine that after it goes through the production process, like any other wine, it is drastically transformed by its aging process, which includes two very weird things. One is called flor, which is a layer of yeast that looks like the 70s popcorn ceiling that grows on the surface of the wine. And the other is the Solera system, which is a method of blending wines. So sherry is never, well, not never, but for the most part is not a single vintage wine. It's a blend of many wines of different ages. And it is a fortified wine, which I think is the hardest part for people. They say, oh, fortified wine, Thunderbird. Like, there's all these negative things that start happening. And but this is a tradition that's been around in the region for over a century. And but it is, I think that the thing about sherry is, and still people are like, oh, is this like a spirit? Is this like a wine? Like, what is it? And it is a wine. The first thing is that it is a wine. It is a wine, though, that sort of lives two lives. It's a wine that is drastically transformed once it ages under this layer of floor, once it goes through the Solera system. And by the way, there is no short way to explain what the hell this thing is. Because it's like people always go, especially lately, you're in tasting, people are like, so like, what is sherry? And you're like, fuck. I don't know. Like, this is how long do you have? Like, this is like a 3-hour conversation. But it is a wine that is freaking delicious. That is all I know for sure.
Well, and there's a huge spectrum.
Right. From Fino all the way to Pedro Ximenez and Moscatel. So this encompasses the sweetest and the driest wines in the world. So that's why it's so hard to like sum this up. Like, how do you sum up a wine that spectrum is that broad? And so it's a wine that can be super pale in color and taste, you know, as close as sherry can to sort of your average white wine, Fino and Manzanilla, all the way to Oloroso, which is totally oxidative and nutty and caramely and totally different than probably any wine that you are drinking on the table. So sherry comes in a range of styles from super, super dry to super, super sweet and everything in between pretty much.
So when compiling this book, did you know how you wanted to lay it out? Did you just have a ton of information and you were like, wah!
Have you been writing this book since you were 11?
Yeah, I've actually been working on this like really hard since I was like 7. No, I knew when I wrote the proposal for this book that I like had a sort of vague idea. Excuse me. Ooh, I just burped a little. Sorry. This is like, it's the morning after, guys.
It's beer.
I'm drinking a lot of beer, which, by the way, should not be consumed on the radio. I had a pretty decent idea of what I wanted it to be, which was a book that was written from an American perspective, because sherry is such this like British thing in the minds of a lot of Americans. And most of the books that have been written about sherry have been written from a British perspective. So I was like, all right, let's do this like American style. Let's put some cocktails in there. Let's like really do this up. Let's talk about what sherry meant to this country. And so I had a pretty clear view of that. And I kind of stuck close to that, actually.
When you break it down by producer,
yeah,
and I mean, I think that's also a really interesting thing because there aren't that many.
No, there's not.
Because when talking about sherry, you're not necessarily talking about who's making it. You're talking about where it's made.
Yeah. I mean, this is a small region. I think a lot of people don't even know that. I mean, this is a really, and it wasn't as small as it is now, but you're talking about like less than 50 bodegas in this whole, 50 bodegas meaning not your corner store where you can buy like really shitty potato salad. Bodega meaning cellar, winery. There are very few of them in this part of the world. And so at one point there were hundreds and it's shrunk dramatically. So that makes it a little easier to get a handle on. But yeah, I think we're talking about history. We're talking about place. We're talking about the culture and answering the question again of like, why does this thing exist? And I think the only way you can answer that question is trying to understand the place, which is understanding flamenco, understanding, you know, the history of cultural influence in the sherry triangle, understanding the tapa, which would not exist, by the way, without sherry. And so I kind of wanted to try and put these things all together and make them hopefully make a little more sense than they did to me, you know, in the beginning.
Why do you think sherry has so many cheerleaders?
Well, I have to quote Levy Dalton because I think he honestly has the best quote of some of the best quotes in this book about sherry. And it's in the chapter called The Modern Sherry Renaissance. And he, you know, talks about how I think our notions of what we want from wine have changed. You know, it's not about 100 points. It's not about immediate gratification. It's where does this come from? Why is it important? How is it, quote unquote, authentic, which is a troubling word. But you know what I mean? And Sherry is nothing if not totally original. I mean, this is what Levy said was, this is the Galapagos Islands of wine. Like, this is, there is nothing like this in the world. And I think that people, what's happened is people like discover this thing for the first time and they're like, holy shit, like, how did I not know about this? Like, how did I not know about this whole tradition, which is what one of the greatest wine traditions in the world? How did I like never know about this? That's powerful, I think, if you're into wine, for sure.
So a segment of the, or a good chunk of the book, it does have sherry cocktails.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a longstanding tradition, right?
For sure.
It's not just like something that all these like hipster cocktail guys were like, oh yeah, sherry's awesome to put
Let's
with other
it
things.
Drink. Ooh, yeah,
it's like boozy.
It. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, no, this you know, and frankly, this is how we've primarily consumed sherry in this country. And the sherry cobbler, which is an awesome drink. It's just sugar, sherry, and citrus. Like, this was like the Cosmo of the 19th century. This is a drink that like captivated the imagination of a lot of drinkers, you know, on both sides of the Atlantic. And if it weren't for the sherry cobbler, I don't think sherry would have become what it is in America at that time. And so I wanted to really talk about our history with those drinks, not only with the sherry cobbler, with drinks like the Adonis, the Bamboo, and forgotten drinks like the Artist Special or the Up-to-Date Cocktail. There are a number of pre-Prohibition era sherry cocktails that are hugely influential in modern cocktailing. And that's a huge part of, honestly, how we're going to drink sherry in this country going forward. It is a big part of how people get interested in this wine, for sure.
With all of the relatively recent, you know, interest in Sherry Fest, your book, Peter Leem's book, have they noticed a difference in sherry sales in Jerez?
Just starting to, you know, and I think people always ask me like what's the mood like in Jerez? Like, how are people feeling? Are they really, you know, there's all this exciting stuff happening. Like, are they excited about the future? And, you know, I think the answer goes back to that. This is a place of contrast, is a place that can't experience joy without suffering. Like, this duality you see in the wine from sweetest to driest, you see it in flamenco from joy and suffering being sort of expressed almost at the same time. And I think that the short answer to this is that yes, they see they see positive movement in the wines, but this is a region that has endured, their wine region has endured a lot of ups and downs. And so I think they're trepidatious about how excited they're actually getting about what's happening. And I think that's a good thing for the Sherry region. Getting too ahead of themselves has ended up screwing the region over in the past, you know, producing too much and producing the wrong wines, you know. So I think being cautious about what this all means is ultimately a really positive thing for Sherry.
I feel like I could talk to you about this forever, but I'm going to cut it.
Yeah.
I'm going to cut it.
It's really good. I could probably talk about this way too long.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just fear getting like too in depth with it because sherry is one of the most mind-boggling things ever. And if you all feel the same, you should 100% get Talia's book.
Thank you.
Check it out. Beautiful photos in there, by the way. Cocktails. You even put your favorite bodegas in there.
Yeah.
And you don't put you're one of your most favorites because you're like, I just don't, there's just such small production of this stuff. So I really appreciate your honesty in the book. So
thank you.
Before we go to break, I'm just curious, just to get off sherry for a second and kind of back to Talia. Do you have like a go-to drink? I mean, you have so many different drinks that you must have to taste, you know, just for work and to keep your website current and updated. But do you have like a local and then they just know, you know, what you want? And so it's just uncomplicated.
Like Talia's here, throw it.
Yeah. I mean, do you have like a go-to when you're like, I can't even think about like all the different kinds of drinks I've like been researching about. I just want my blank.
I drink whiskey straight.
Okay.
I drink scotch and or rye. And I, that's my like, or like a Boilermaker. I drink a shot in a beer. Like for me, that is like wine down stuff. Like when you don't want to think about anything and I have different go-to drinks for different scenarios. Like if I'm at a wedding, for example, which you really got to have a go-to drink at a wedding because you get in some bad situations.
Good advice.
I drink a lot of Aperol spritzes at weddings. Mm. And this is like, these are highbrow weddings because
it's like Aperol. You know, fancy.
Like if you can get some Aperol up in there, like I would actually recommend just bringing a bottle of Aperol because people really get into it. They do. Like if there's going to be some shitty sparkling something, it might be Corbel or Andre, but like it's gonna be okay if he puts an Aperol in it. So like there, that goes down. It is. And I actually, like, a recent wedding, I really bonded with like, a lot of people over this spritz. So everyone's like, what are we gonna drink here? I don't really know, like, what's happening. I was like, just stick with me, it's gonna be fine. We got a little Aperol here, we're gonna fix it.
She's like, I BYOB.
Yeah. I would stick with you anytime there's a bar.
And a flask. Always bring a flask to a wedding.
Great advice.
We're gonna take a break here on the morning after. We're gonna come back with the morning after quiz. Get ready, Talia.
Oof.
Actually, you're listening to The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. We're here with Talia
Silly
Bayoki.
Children.
Silly children. I'm Jessie Kiefer.
I am still Sari Kamen.
It is time for The Morning After quiz. Three questions, all multiple choice. You're not intended to know these, Talia. Mm-hmm. So, Talia, we know you know about your online mag Punch, but what do you know about everyone's favorite fruity punch in the face? Hawaiian Punch. Here comes The Morning After quiz. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right.
I'm so terrified.
Question one. I'm glad to strike some fear into you. Yeah. You wrote this whole book about Sherry and you're afraid of this.
Yeah.
Good Lord. All right. Question one. Developed in 1934 by A.W. Leo, what was the original intended usage of Hawaiian Punch? Is it A, a substitute for grenadine? Is it B, an ice cream topping? Or is it C, cough syrup flavoring?
What was the year?
1934.
Grenadine substitute?
You're going to go with A.
I'm going to go with A. Substitute.
You were actually incorrect.
Fuck.
That's the one I said too.
But that makes sense. Tiki? Come on. Hawaii?
I know, but it was actually an ice cream topping.
Yeah, you're thinking cap doesn't help.
That was
at
my
all
last choice.
One.
That was my last choice.
That's I
me too.
Okay, so logic, do not be logical.
No, nope. Throw logic out the window. You should have known that when you got into the studio with us.
It's true.
Second question. Named for its original 7-fruit-flavored recipe, which of these fruits is not in Hawaiian Punch? Is it A, apricot, B, apple, or C, strawberry?
I'm going to say... I'm gonna say A, stone fruit, kind of like weird.
You're gonna say A, apricot.
You're gonna say, yeah.
Final answer?
Yeah, final answer.
No, actually, there is apricot in Hawaiian Punch. Why the hell that makes sense? I have no idea. But actually, sea strawberry is not in it. There's actually nothing red in it.
I'm over it. I hate this quiz.
You're welcome.
I said apricot too.
The seven fruits in Hawaiian Punch are the original Hawaiian Punch.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
there's
I
actually only
this.
5% fruit juice. It's apple, apricot, guava, orange, papaya, passion fruit, and pineapple. Nothing is red.
I said
so it's like kernels. Someone just like poured some kernels fruit nectar. Exactly.
Yeah, some I was like, apricots aren't local in Hawaii.
I mean, yeah, I know.
That's not seasonal.
Yeah. Apricot really doesn't make sense.
It makes
though.
No sense.
Really we're going at this it, totally yeah, the wrong.
I went yeah. totally wrong way.
Yeah.
All right. Well, final question. You okay. save yourself. Known for his Hawaiian shirt, strange antler-like hair, and loaded catchphrase, what is the name of the Hawaiian Punch mascot? Is it A, Hula Jim? Is it B, Punchy the Puncher? Is it C, the Big Island Juicer?
I mean, I'm only going with C because I really hope it's the Big Island Juicer.
You're going with C, yeah. the Big Island Juicer. Talia, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. I owe you several beers for not allowing you to get any correct. It's actually Punchy the Puncher.
That's stupid.
Dumbest.
It's Punchy for short. It's
look, like let's call the Hawaiian Punch after this. I have a bone to pick on the yeah. Hawaiian Punch.
I mean, they should have called me when they were looking for this mascot.
That's like the I think laziest the gym and name Big Island anyone could Punchy ever the Puncher? Come up with.
Someone was definitely...
Punchy's not even a name.
No.
Well, you guys remember his catchphrase, how'd you like a nice Hawaiian punch?
Doesn't mean and your name is Punchy.
He punches the person in the face.
I mean, isn't that like a convenient name that his name is Punchy and he punches people?
Of course it is. This is developed in like the 60s.
Well, I feel like Hawaiian Punch is not very creative. Okay?
I don't think so.
Yeah. And again, it's 5% juice in a powder mixture. You add your own sugar. It's crap.
There's yeah. clearly something in that that made all the executives brain dead.
Talia, thank you for being such a good sport.
Thank you.
With the morning after quiz. It's a pleasure having you on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Tell us your Instagram, Twitter things so people can follow
it's,
if they
oh
like.
Oh, God. It's my name, which is so hard. it's Talia Baiocchi at all of those things. At Talia Baiocchi on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
And then there's one for Punch as well.
Oh, Punch. Yeah, that's better. Punch _ drink because thank you, Hawaiian Punch. You own Punch.com and all of the other Punch things.
I had no idea. Yeah. Oh, man.
We considered it. We're like, maybe we should try to like go up against. Nope. Never nope. mind. Yeah.
Yeah.
Punch the Puncher.
There's also some you don't guy, fuck with that guy on Instagram whose name is Punch.
Yeah.
And I tagged that by accident.
Yeah, I always do, too.
Yeah. It was like in Arabic or something. Yeah. Not that guy.
Yes, Punch _ drink for and all of those.
The website is punchdrink.com.
Punchdrink.com. Thank you for promoting my things.
You're tired, I know. Sari, always lovely to spend Sunday with you.
Same.
Thanks, guys.
This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.